UN panel says the United States should close its prison at Guantanamo Bay and avoid using secret detention facilities in its war on terrorism. Mexico and four Central American nations publicly condemn the U.S. plan to build hundreds of miles of barrier on the U.S.-Mexican border. And local activists who spent 20 years trying to shut down the Trojan nuclear plant reflect on the upcoming Trojan implosion. Today's Portland area weather forecast, partly sunny with a chance of showers in the afternoon and cooler with highs around 70. And tonight, mostly cloudy with a chance of showers and lows around 50. Saturday, mostly cloudy with a chance of showers and highs in the upper 60s.
Anger and apathy are the most common reasons experts are citing for the low turnout in this week's primary election. Bill Kenemer, chair of the Clackamas County Commission, used those words to describe what he sees as a growing citizen disengagement since the 1980s. And Portland pollster Adam Davis, who has been surveying voters for almost 30 years, says he has never seen as disconnected from public officials as they are now. The turnout was 38% of Oregon's 2 million registered voters. When official election results are finalized in a few weeks, it will go down as either the second or third lowest turnout in a statewide primary in more than 40 years. One likely factor is the rise of the independent voter. 80% of the state's independent voters did not participate Tuesday. Independents were not allowed to have their say in the Republican and Democratic races for governor, leaving them to decide lower profile and often uncontested races. There were also no statewide ballot measures to generate interest. Former Secretary of State Phil Kiesling sees the turnout as an opportunity to gather support for an open primary initiative he is trying to get on November ballot. Under an open primary, all voters, independents, Republicans, and Democrats would get the same ballot, and the top two vote-getters in each race would advance.
Oregon National Guard officials say they will edit or replace a recruiting sign at the National Guard Armory in Corvallis as a result of objections from protesters who have been camping out near the building. The protesters, for their part, removed a display of cardboard coffins, including some small ones symbolizing dead Iraqi children, from the sidewalk in front of the armory. They also took away boots and civilian shoes, symbolizing the Iraq War's toll. The two sides have been trying to accommodate each other in a protest that began on Sunday. The protesters labeled as misleading a sign in front of the building that reads, 100% tuition paid. Major Chris Reese said his unit will change the sign to say that there's a $4,500 annual cap on the tuition payments, or, he said, officials might change the sign to read, "Join the home team." Reese insisted the 100% tuition slogan was not misleading. Lee Bolger, one of the protest organizers, called the proposed changes a good compromise.
Next Sunday, May 21st at 7 a.m., PGE plans to blow up the main cooling tower of the mothballed Trojan nuclear plant. The blast is expected to last 8 seconds, but the Trojan story has lasted for years, and it's not over yet. KBOO's Spencer Raymond presents the opinions of a few of the activists who spent almost 20 years trying to shut Trojan down.
Well, every nuclear reactor is basically an atomic bomb with the clutch in.
The plant was built with about half the earthquake capacity that it was designed to have. The PGE's engineers, a firm called Pre-Scouty out of San Francisco, a world-class firm, looked at Trojan and said that basically if you sneezed, it would fall over, and that it was completely misdesigned, and so that no one could even calculate what kind of earthquake resistance it would have, but that it wouldn't be good.
Started a movement called the Sunday Nuclear Boycott, or SNUB. And the idea was for people to light a candle in their window and turn out their lights on Sunday night in protest of nuclear power and the operation of the Trojan nuclear power plant.
Unbeknownst to anybody at the time the plant was built, we live in the most menacing earthquake zone in the world. We have the Cascadia subduction zone just off the Oregon coast, and every 300 years or so, it gives way. And gives us earthquakes as large as the planet knows how to generate.
The sighting of a reactor in the terribly geologically active and unstable area like the Cascades and the Columbia River Basin is just ludicrous.
And then we performed a 9-week march through the most populated area of Oregon. We went down the coast of Oregon, over to the Willamette Valley at Florence into Eugene, and then all the way up the Willamette Valley to Portland, and we ended at Trojan. That was a 9-week walk, and we had a display of alternative energy exhibit on wheels on the back of a flatbed trailer that followed us around.
The first and foremost vulnerability of every single nuclear reactor in the world is that they depend on off-site power for the running of everything on site, like the cooling for the reactor core.
You know, we were plugged into a national effort, but the grunt work was Oregonians.
During the whole period of time when we were fighting to shut down Trojan, we were being told that, well, we couldn't shut down Trojan because we need that energy. You know, Portland and Oregon absolutely couldn't survive without Trojan. No, Trojan shut down, and as far as I know, Portland's still there. Everybody's still alive and well. I think that it's a compelling example of how we can survive without nuclear power. When if we need to, we can find ways to reduce our energy consumption.
Leakage becomes not just a maintenance issue, it becomes a safety issue over time. And when the major pipes start having embrittlement from the intense heat and radioactivity, this is not a small matter. And we are seeing failure of pipes that the industry said would never fail. Trojan was definitely entering the second half of its operative life and into that second half of the bathtub curve. Thankfully, it was closed before any of those terrible things happened.
I think that it's a very compelling example of how grassroots efforts can eventually succeed, maybe not as fast as we would like them to, but ultimately public involvement highlights issues which otherwise would not be highlighted. Maybe Trojan never would have shut down if it weren't for the fact that suddenly the spotlight was pointed at nuclear power and the weaknesses and dangers involved with it. And so regulators had to act when maybe they would not have otherwise.
It's well known that the radioactivity of a reactor is sufficient to activate the concrete of cooling towers. Even, you know, they may also be contaminated, which is a different issue, but simply the proximity to the amount of radiation activates the concrete. And so that material, even if they claim, oh, it never got contaminated, is radioactive. And as they implode, as in any explosion, you're going to be creating dust and small particles. There's no way that's all going to be contained on site. And then there's the big question, what are they going to do with it? And I wish I could answer that question for you, but, you know, where is this going to go? However, it should be done, you know, with remote imaging and shared on film. I really think it's a mistake for people to turn out and potentially get covered with that powder and dust.
I don't think it's dangerous to blow it up. The cooling tower itself is not radioactive. I think it should be left there as a monument to human folly. I mean, it's a great story, and every time you drive to Seattle, you have a chance to tell the children the story about how you know, history made a wrong turn.
That was Portland attorney Greg Coffrey speaking to KBOO's Spencer Raymond. Also speaking were former Portlanders Mary Olson of the Nuclear Information and Resource Center in Washington, D.C., and Avram Friedman of the Canary Coalition in South Carolina. Tune in all this week for ongoing Trojan implosion coverage, and don't miss the KBOO Evening News next Monday night, May 22nd, for the exclusive coverage of the implosion and its after effects.
A unique anti-war event is scheduled in Portland this weekend. KBOO's Jessica Rink-Perry reports.
This Saturday, members of the new organization Combatants for Peace and Iraq Vets Against the War will talk about their experiences serving in Palestine and Iraq, as well as what they are doing to challenge their government's policies. Speakers will discuss their experiences serving as part of a military occupation, what moved them to refuse military service, and how they are working against war now. The event takes place this Saturday, May 20th, at 7 p.m. at St. Francis Church at Southeast 12th and Pine in Portland. Speakers will include Dan Zaher, a former soldier in the Israeli infantry, and Joe Hatcher, a U.S. Army veteran. Zaher was jailed in Israel in 2003 after he refused, as a conscientious objector, to serve in the compulsory Israeli army. Since then, he has been active in the organizations Courage to Refuse and Combatants for Peace. Hatcher served in Iraq for over a year and is an active member of Iraq Veterans Against the War. Kabu had the chance to speak with them earlier this week. Zaher is part of a large but seldom heard peace movement in Israel, comprised of Israeli and Palestinian former soldiers. They are speaking to students in the Middle East with a message of hope.
And today, instead of fighting each other, we're having a dialogue. And we try to show it, to promote the dialogue, to promote peace by talking with some young people in high schools, both in Israel and in Palestine, and to show that dialogue is possible.
Zaher represents a side of the Middle East that is forgotten in the United States, where suicide bombings make for eye-grabbing headlines.
The peace movement in Israel and in Palestine are quite big, and no one hears about it on the CNN, when they read the newspapers.
In spite of selective news coverage, Joe Hatcher believes it's not a matter of informing the American public of the nature of the occupation in Iraq, but of rallying Americans to action.
We are currently involved in the illegal occupation of a sovereign nation to secure its natural resources.
Hatcher has numerous complaints to level against our government's treatment of its soldiers and the support they actually receive.
The lack of proper equipment and training, the health issues that veterans face, including depleted uranium, post-traumatic stress, white phosphorus, larium, complete disregard for international law, soldiers that have been affected by the war profiteering, stop loss, people whose families have been destroyed by deployments too often and too long.
He says Americans know what is happening in Iraq and need to make their feelings known to their representatives in Congress.
Right now, I believe that the American public should be making those who they've elected aware that they're no longer serving the public's needs and wants.
Hatcher is calling attention to the realities of the Iraq War in hopes that Americans will be motivated to seek new leadership in the November elections.
And we need a social awakening to where we can retake our government, and we can retake our lives. There was a time when the government was afraid of the people, not vice versa, and we need to return to that.
I'm Jessica Rink Perry reporting for KABU News.
In California, a man was rushed to the hospital with internal injuries after falling or jumping some 30 feet from a bridge after police fired a taser at him. California police responded to reports of a man accosting drivers yesterday morning. They found the man, identified as 28-year-old Chad Robbins, banging on cars and yelling and taking things off cars. Officers say Robbins indicated he wanted to hurt himself, then placed his hands atop a 4-foot-high fence along the bridge as if to jump. Police say they used the taser against him to keep him from jumping, but he went over the edge anyway. It's unclear whether the taser dart actually struck Robbins. The district attorney's office is investigating the case.
The United States should close its prison at Guantanamo Bay and avoid using secret detention facilities in the war on terror. That's the recommendation of the UN panel that monitors compliance with the world's anti-torture treaty. The Committee Against Torture also said today that detainees should not be returned to any country where they could face a real risk of being tortured. The critical report followed a hearing in Geneva on whether the U.S. is adhering to the 1984 UN Convention Against Torture. The committee said it was worried that detainees were being held for protracted periods with insufficient legal safeguards and without court assessment of the justification for their detention. The committee also expressed concern about allegations that the United States has established secret prisons where the International Red Cross does not have access to the detainees. The panel said the United States must halt all forms of torture committed by its personnel in Afghanistan and Iraq and investigate allegations thoroughly, prosecuting any staff found guilty. It said the United States also should rescind any interrogation technique that constitutes torture or cruel, inhuman, or degrading treatment or punishment. U.S. officials in Geneva declined to comment immediately today. The panel asked the United States to report back within a year.
Human rights groups are applauding the UN torture watchdog's tough stance against the U.S. The American Civil Liberties Union says the committee's message leaves no doubt that U.S. practices violate bedrock principles against torture and abuse. Human Rights Watch says the panel rejected the U.S. position that its intelligence operations should be outside the committee's scrutiny. A spokesperson says she hopes the U.S. takes the criticism to heart and significantly shifts its policies.
Attorneys for Enron founder Kenneth Lay said the automated signature machine did it. They suggest bank loan documents containing terms he allegedly violated actually were signed by an automatic signature device. Lay went on trial yesterday on one count of bank fraud and three counts of making false statements regarding personal banking issues. The trial began one day after jurors began deliberating the nearly four-month-long fraud and conspiracy case against Lay and former Enron chief executive Jeffrey Skilling. Lay is charged with six counts in that case and Skilling with 28. In the bank fraud case, prosecutors allege that beginning in 1999, Lay obtained $75 million in loans from three banks and then reneged on an agreement with the lenders that he wouldn't use the money to carry or buy stock. Lay used his Enron stock as collateral for the loans. Lenders issued margin calls as Enron's share price fell throughout 2001, which he said prompted him to tap the company for cash and repay the energy giant with Enron stock. The prosecutor says Lay repeatedly, time and again, over a period of years, drew down on the loans to buy stock. One of Lay's lawyers said many of the documents involved may have been signed by the automatic machine that had templates with the signatures of Lay and his wife.
A Senate committee approved a constitutional amendment banning same-sex marriage yesterday. The approval came after a shouting match that ended when one Democrat strode out and the Republican chairman bid him good riddance. Judiciary Committee Chair Arlen Specter shouted after Senator Russ Feingold declared his opposition to the amendment, his affinity for the Constitution, and his intention to leave the meeting. The panel voted along party lines to send the constitutional amendment, which would prohibit states from recognizing same-sex marriages, to the full Senate. It stands little chance of passing there. Democrats complained that bringing up the amendment is a purely political move designed to appeal to the Republican conservative base in this year of midterm elections. Not all those who voted yes support the amendment, however. Specter said he is totally opposed to it, but felt it deserved a debate in the Senate. Senate Majority Leader Bill Frist has scheduled a vote on the proposed amendment the week of June 5th.
Ex-New York Times reporter Judith Miller says an anonymous White House source leaked top-secret intelligence to her about an impending al-Qaeda attack 2 months before 9/11. In an interview with Alternet.com, Miller said both she and her editor, Stephen Engelberg, now regret not doing the story. Engelberg is now managing editor of The Oregonian. Miller said that the people who were worried about al-Qaeda believed that there would be an attack on a major American target in the weekend before July 4th in 2001. After nothing happened that weekend, a White House source told Miller that there was some concern about an intercept that had been picked up between two members of al-Qaeda. One operative was overheard saying to the other, "Don't worry, we're planning something so big now that the U.S. will have to respond." Miller says that she and Engelberg decided against publishing this story because she could not pin down more specific details about the people and places involved. Judith Miller was at the center of the case involving former top White House official I. Lewis Scooter Libby. She spent 85 days in jail before finally disclosing that Libby was the anonymous source who confirmed to her that Valerie Plame was a CIA official. Miller never wrote a story about Plame.
Commissioners in Mercer County, Pennsylvania, are suing the Dublin-based maker of the Patriot touchscreen voting system, alleging breach of warranty. The lawsuit seeks more than $925,000 in damages from Unilect. The machines caused a problem in the 2004 presidential election in Mercer County, where votes were apparently lost through human error or mechanical problems. The company has blamed the problem on an error in ballot coding and the omission of a test by the county elections office. In April 2005, the state banned three counties, including Mercer, from using the Patriot systems they had used for several years. County officials say they have been told by Unilect that the company has given up attempts to have the system recertified by the state.
A lawsuit brought by a German citizen who says he was kidnapped and beaten by the CIA has been dismissed by a U.S. court. This from the BBC. Khaled El-Masri planned to sue former CIA chief George Tenet and other officials for their alleged role in the extraordinary rendition program. He says he was picked up in Macedonia in 2003 and flown to Kabul, Afghanistan, and tortured. The judge did not rule on the truth of the allegations, but said letting the case proceed might endanger security. The American Civil Liberties Union brought the case on behalf of El-Masri, who was never charged with any terrorist offenses. Along with Tenet, the case named 10 other CIA employees, as well as three other companies and their employees. However, the district court judge in Virginia rejected the challenge, saying El-Masri's private interest must give way to the national interest in preserving state secrets. He has alleged he was beaten and injected with drugs after being seized near Macedonia's border with Albania before being taken to Afghanistan and held for 5 months. In his ruling, Judge T.S. Ellis stressed that by rejecting El-Masri's lawsuit, he made no judgment on the strength of his allegations. He said that, in times of war, our country, chiefly through the executive branch, must often take exceptional steps to thwart the enemy. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice has admitted that the U.S. has used so-called extraordinary rendition, or secret flights, to move suspects across international borders.
The House yesterday rejected an attempt to end the quarter-century ban on oil and natural gas drilling that has been in effect for 85% of the country's coastal waters from Alaska to New England. Lawmakers from Florida and California, who led the fight to continue the drilling moratorium, said they feared energy projects as close as 3 miles from the shore could jeopardize multi-billion-dollar tourism industries in their states. The issue, which dominated debate on an Interior Department spending bill, saw the sides split largely along geographic, not partisan lines. Republicans and Democrats from coastal states opposed lifting the drilling restrictions.
The World Wildlife Fund says governments must step up enforcement of fishing limits in international waters to prevent fish species from disappearing. WWF said today that problems in international waters include many governments ignoring controls and increasing catches. The report said regulations under so-called regional fisheries management organizations need to be tightened to restrict overfishing. It added that management organizations are constrained predominantly by the lack of political will, commercial motivations, or the capacity of their members. The fund's Simon Cripps said countries like Australia, Britain, and Canada should be taking more responsibility, setting examples and putting pressure on other states. In its latest report on the state of the world fisheries, the UN Food and Agriculture Organization estimated that a quarter of the fish stocks it monitors were overexploited or depleted. A further half were fully exploited, meaning they were producing catches close to their maximum sustainable limits.
Mexico and four Central American nations publicly condemned the U.S. plan to build hundreds of miles of fencing on its southern border. In a joint news conference in Mexico City late yesterday, the foreign ministers of Guatemala, Honduras, Nicaragua, Costa Rica, and Mexico said that building barriers was not the way to solve problems between neighboring nations. On Wednesday, the U.S. Senate approved a proposal to build 370 miles of triple-layer fencing along parts of the border separating the U.S. and Mexico. The Senate also agreed to give many undocumented immigrants a shot at U.S. citizenship. Earlier Thursday, Mexico's Foreign Relations Department sent a note to the U.S. State Department outlining the nation's concerns about the proposed barrier. Mexican President Vicente Fox repeated his ongoing criticisms of the wall yesterday, comparing such a barrier to the Berlin Wall. On the border with Arizona, oppressed migrants who had been turned back by the Border Patrol said that more fences would not keep them from crossing, but only make smugglers charge more money for the trip.
A judge questioned Chile's General Augusto Pinochet about the disappearance of scores of dissidents during his regime. The action could lead to an indictment against the former dictator. Judge Victor Montilio, who interviewed Pinochet for almost 2 hours yesterday at his mansion, said the former ruler had fully cooperated. Pinochet has been stripped of legal immunity in the case. The questioning is the last step in a process that could lead Montilio to indict Pinochet for the disappearance of 37 dissidents during the so-called Operation Colombo, in which 119 dissidents were killed. At the time of the killings, the Pinochet regime claimed the victims died in clashes between rival opposition groups. Montilio has already indicted Pinochet in 9 cases, which are being handled separately because relatives of the victims filed individual suits against Pinochet. The charges cited in the case are kidnapping because the bodies of the victims were never recovered. Pinochet has not been convicted on any charges stemming from his dictatorship, and the indictments do not guarantee that Pinochet will stand trial. In 2 other recent cases involving other military officers, Montilio has dropped the charges by applying a controversial amnesty law issued by the Pinochet regime in 1978.
That's the KBOO Morning News for Friday, May 19th, 2006. Today's Portland area weather forecast, partly sunny with a slight chance of showers in the afternoon, cooler, highs around 70. Tonight, mostly cloudy with a chance of showers, lows around 50. Saturday, mostly cloudy with a chance of showers, highs 65 to 70. Sunday, mostly cloudy with a chance of showers, highs around 70. If you have any questions or comments about what you heard this morning, give us a call at 503-231-8032. Leave a message on extension 202 or send us an email at amnews@kboo.org. You're listening to KBOO at 90.7 FM in Portland, in Corvallis at 100.7 FM on translator K264AA, and in Hood River at 91.9 FM on translator K220HR. You can log on to our website at kboo.fm. Our producer for this morning's newscast is Kathleen Stevenson. Our engineer is Brian Smith. I'm Jake Wolner.
And I'm Liam Delta.
Coming up this morning on KBOO,